I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode.
When 75% of all the bank financing was regional banks, and the majority of that was doing construction financing, and they're fundamentally out of the market, that means that we are going to see a significant, and we're seeing it already, slowdown in new deliveries in commercial real estate. Historically, supply has always been a big issue. It's killed the golden goose, and then we recover, right? But we don't really have that dynamic besides a few specific markets. So through my lens, I look at these fundamentals and we will go up and down and have some bumps, and maybe we'll be surprised by weakness in the consumer here or there. But I think long term, those fundamentals still remain really strong.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Warren Dahan, CEO and co-founder of Acor Capital, one of the largest non-bank lenders in commercial real estate in the United States. We discuss Warren's journey into commercial real estate, why scale matters, as well as unpacking the nuances of how credit is deployed when capital stacks are broken, but real estate fundamentals remain strong. Let's get into it. Warren, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brandon. Good to be here.
For our listeners who haven't met you or aren't familiar, can you please introduce yourself and your organization?
Sure. I'm Warren Dahan. I am the CEO and co-founder of Acor Capital, and we are one of the largest non-bank lenders in commercial real estate in the United States.
Excellent. So we're going to talk today about non-bank lending. We're going to talk about your career. We're going to talk about your journey into real estate. So let's go back to the early days. I think a lot of people are familiar with Acor, but maybe not the story behind the story. So how did you get into the commercial real estate business? And let's kind of take it, step ladder it forward until the time when you decide to start Acor.
Well, that's a hell of a story. How much time do we have?
We got time. Let's go.
Well, I guess my path was somewhat unorthodox. I grew up in South Africa. I have parents who unfortunately didn't have the opportunity to go to university. And I'd say their primary objective in life in bringing my sisters and myself up was to get us as well educated as possible. And that really meant spending every last dollar on making sure that we had the opportunities that they didn't have. I was very fortunate then to get the opportunity to go to hotel management school in Switzerland. And the sort of genesis of that was really, look, I've always enjoyed the idea of business. I love businesses where you have to combine, you know, a high degree of EQ and IQ in order to get to the top of the chain. The hospitality business is an interesting place to learn because if you think about a hotel, you have every type of business inside a hotel, right? You have finance and accounting, you have sales and marketing, you have customer service, and the list goes on. And you have CapEx. I mean, these are big properties with a lot of capital in them. You have debt, you have equity, and you have a broad spectrum of stakeholders that you need to keep happy. And I found that fascinating. So I got this great opportunity, jumped on a plane, went off to Switzerland and dove right in. And You know, I certainly found my footing in that environment. It was massively stimulating. And I really found a capability, let's say, and a passion for the business aspects of hospitality. During that period of time, I did some internships at some of the best hotels in the world in Zurich and Geneva, and then ultimately had an opportunity to go to Cornell University. And for some reason I can't really explain to you, I decided not to go to Cornell that year, but decided to take the position in the bowels of the Dorchester Hotel in London as the assistant steward in the kitchen. So I wasn't a chef. I was more somewhere between a managing the pot washers and managing the silverware, somewhere in there. And not really sure where my mind was at the time. And I remember making £13,000 a year, working split shift. So effectively, you would have to work in a shift early in the morning, and then you'd work in a shift later in the afternoon or evening. And, you know, let's just say it wasn't particularly enjoyable. And London is one of the greatest cities in the world, but you need to have disposable money to really enjoy the benefits of London. And one day I remember coming out of the Dorchester Hotel, walking up Park Lane and walking into a McLaren store and seeing that McLaren F1 car, which was at the time, you know, a £540,000 vehicle, which today is worth over 20 million, by the way, if you're a car lover. And I remember saying to myself, well, if I work for 40 years and I save 100% of my money, and I don't spend a pound, I'll be able to afford this car. And that was quite a daunting thought for someone who's fairly ambitious. And at that time, my closest friend, Sean Hare, who's a fellow South African Botswana fellow, and I had met going to Switzerland, and he went off to Cornell. And I remember the phone calls I would get from him. It was like, come on, man. You know, these guys come here to Cornell and they study finance, and then we go and work on Wall Street, and, you know, it's great and it's exciting and it's fast paced. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, okay, I got to go visit. So my now wife and I jumped on the cheapest flight we could get, which was Air India. And we flew over to New York. And I actually remember coming in and literally the plane missed the runway and took back off again. I was like, oh my gosh. And we went up to Ithaca and were welcomed in. And then I decided that that would be a great opportunity. And my father blessed that, as did my mother. And I spent a little less than 2 years there working during the summer and the winter. During the winter in Ithaca is not a pleasant thing either. And, you know, doing the course as quickly as reasonably possible. And along the way, I was very fortunate with a couple of my finance professors who were very, you know, I got on with very well. I did very well in the courses. I found them very interesting and intriguing. And I could see a path between the studies and the practical implementation of what I was learning, which I think this is an incredibly important lesson for all educators, is to be able to connect the student and their minds and ambitions with what the practical day-to-day is going to look like around their optionality set. And in my case, commercial real estate finance, whether that's debt or equity, and what that would look like if I stepped into it. And at the time, there was an incredibly talented group of people started a company, a real estate finance business at Nomura. It was Nomura Asset Capital Corporation within the Japanese Investment Bank. And this crew was nothing short of inspirational. The energy, the intellectual horsepower, the physicality. I mean, these guys were athletes. They would literally, you know, they were going to win in life regardless of what they were going to do, where they applied their mental capacity to and their physical capacity and their money. Ultimately, these are people who are going to make a huge difference in the world. And during the interview process when I was coming out, it was a little bit unfortunate. I know that there's those of your listeners who are international, struggled with the same issues at the time, where I remember looking at the interviews. It was Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley was the first round. And underneath the box, it said, no foreign students. In other words, only if you had a green card or a US citizenship could you apply for the job. And that was disheartening, really, because certainly any person who wants to be in finance would want to choose those companies. And then the next week, Nomura came around and they had the same sign on the box. And I looked at this and I said, screw that, put my resume inside there. And guess what? Lo and behold, I got a call. I got a call for the interview, and one thing led to the next. They then, you know, invited me back to New York to meet with the senior team and offered me the job. So I guess there's a great lesson in that. Had I said no, or had caved to that shield that they had put up, I would not be where I am today in terms of my finance career. And then, you know, I got the opportunity to go work there. And then it's about the people you work with, you know, it's about the deal flow. And what I say to a lot of people today, I was recently talking at a university, and I was talking to the graduate students. And one thing I said to them is, when you're making your decision to go and work at a firm now, do not make the decision over $10,000, $15,000, even though it's a big percentage of your earnings in your first year. That shouldn't be what you focus on. What you need to focus in on is, how much can I learn during my time with this firm? And how much deal flow am I going to see? And how do I personally fit my skill? What is my personal superpower? Is it EQ? Is it IQ? Am I a math brain? Am I particularly good at sales? Whatever it might be, is find your it's not your passion, but find your talent. And fit that into a company that has a lot of velocity. And I would say, for me, I chose the right firm for the reasons I mentioned before. But secondly is, Nomura had a very large percentage of the market share for CMBS. We were seeing every deal on the planet. It also gave me an opportunity to get thrown in the deep end, sink or swim, right? If I didn't swim, I would have sank. I would have been out of there. That was the mentality. But I got this greatest opportunity as an analyst to jump in the deep end and learn a ton. But there was a significant unwinding in the capital markets, or a mark to market, particularly on securities. And the Japanese came in and decided to shut that business down. And we were all fundamentally laid off. And as a not funny, but funny side note, you know, I think it's not a terrible thing for everyone to be laid off at some point in their life, because if you're in the fast-paced business, it's inevitable that at some point you're going to get laid off for some reason or another. So that then gave us an opportunity to step aside. I've had this great fortune of having exceptional partners. And that's another, I think, lesson learned, is in life, having these high-quality partnerships, whether it's your wife, great relationships with your children, your business partners, there is a multiplying effect of not only your psychic disposition, but it's also the other benefits in life that you get out of it, the guidance, the support, the idea that as one individual, as multiple individuals that all respect each other, big word, right? You have to respect each other, that there's a multiplying effect on your existence as a result of great partnerships. And so myself, a gentleman named Boyd Fellows, Stu Ward, and Chris Tarkowski decided that we wanted to stay in San Francisco. We did not want to move back to the East Coast. And we cobbled together a company called Coastal Capital Partners. And as a side note, there are a few folks that joined us at Coastal Capital Partners at the time that are still with us today. And there's a really interesting story. My CIO today is a gentleman named Kyle Jeffers. Kyle joined Nomura as an asset manager in my team at the time. I think it was 1997. he then moved out to San Francisco, and he's a great athlete. He's a great cyclist too. And I remember at Coastal Capital Partners, we said to him, Kyle, we can't really pay you, but we'll buy you a bicycle. So we bought him a really badass mountain bike, and he's like, yeah, that sounds good. And he jumps on board and, you know, has been with us ever since and has had a fantastic career being, you know, the top originator for us at various firms we worked at. And today he's our CIO. So again, along these themes of long-dated partnerships, the form and substance of partnerships change, but fundamentally having those partnerships in life is really a great blessing. And so in, I forget, it was 2004, 2005, Countrywide at the time was the largest mortgage company in the world. And coincidentally based in Calabasas, California. And through a mutual friend of one of my partners, we went to visit with the senior leadership there. And we sat down with them. They all had the Wall Street mentality. They were all very grateful for their lives on the West Coast but needed to be in at 5 a.m. And there was a great meeting of the minds where the idea was that they wanted to launch a commercial mortgage-backed securities business. And they had heard about us. And so they fundamentally acquired us, to use that term a little bit loosely. Very exciting days, to be honest. And for me personally, it was extremely exciting to step into the largest mortgage machine in the world, in the US at least, maybe in the world, and with my partners to go in with a real budget and a real capability and a real balance sheet to go and build a CMBS business. And use all the lessons that we had learned from Nomura during the long-term capital crisis to build a better business than what we had before. And that was a very exciting time. We built that business to about 250 people. We were doing about $15 billion a year of CMBS loans. We were running a very tight and profitable business. And then 2008 comes along. And one day, I remember the four of us were sitting down with our boss at the time, a gentleman named Ron Cripollone, a tremendous mind and one of the greatest guys ever to work for. And he sat there and he said, guys, what is going on in CMBS? Because in residential spreads, there's a lot of volatility. Spreads are widening, but your spreads are staying flat, or in some cases tightening. These markets are parallel markets and are highly correlated. We got to start developing a short here because this is going to end badly. So with that insight, we started to develop a very significant hedging strategy led by my partner, Stu Ward. And then Chris Tarkowski's genius within that realm was his ability to argue with the rating agencies, to make cases that other deals were getting treatment that was too favorable at the rating agencies, which they were, for poor collateral. And we decided at that point to pull back on our originations and not do these 10-year IO loans. And then secondly, develop a very detailed hedge around our portfolio of loans. So as you play that through towards the end, we had about $4.5 billion of loans in position. We had developed a significant hedge, which started off being incredibly expensive, but we had conviction around it. And plus, we had learned a lot of lessons from Nomura too. We had stopped making new loans effectively, and certainly no 10-year IO loans. And you know, under the guidance of the rating agencies, they said, go ahead and just keep making the loans. And we're like, okay, we got to stop this now. And then things came unglued for the market, as you well remember. Not just for the market at large, we saw tremendous spread. I mean, we saw AAA spreads at 13, 14%, you know, up 1,000 basis points. Just a crazy good buying opportunity, but massively impactful on a mark-to-market basis on securities, right? But we had the magic of our hedge in place. So, you know, as we played that through, we took our origination team and we started selling all these loans at a discount. It started at like 98 cents and it ended up at like 50 cents to the regional banks who started buying these loans. Eventually, we whittled down the portfolio to about $300 million, $200 to $300 million. And we had this this loss at the loan level, but we had this massive gain at the hedge level. So net-net, when Bank of America came into Countrywide, our parent company, they had just bought another competitor, which was a complete mess. And they came to us and they said, I can't believe how clean your book is. I mean, there's like $200 million of loans. You've hedged these things. We've got like a $200 million gain on the hedges. And you guys have done a fantastic job. And there was a lady at the time who was running the business, Rochelle Dobbs, who dealt with these complicated issues at the most professional level I think I've seen in my career, where she looked at us and said, you guys deserve your change in control economics. You deserve to pay your team. And, you know, you deserve to basically be set free here without any constraints and get paid out at what you were supposed to under your contract, where somebody else could have messed with us, by the way. And that's what we did. And we handed them the $200 million in loans. We gave them the $200 million in gains. We wrapped up the team and we all left at the time. We then went back to our Coastal Capital days and we started doing a lot of advisory work, advising clients on some massive meltdowns that existed in the markets at the time, which was really educational. I learned a ton. And then in 2010, I believe it was, Barry Sternlicht and various other folks like the Ares folks, Colony Capital, and others had raised these mortgage REITs, which were blind pool pockets of money raised in the public markets to go and invest in distressed commercial real estate debt. And Barry, to his credit, vacuumed up $900 million of capital, significantly more than the others. And he then has known one of my partners, was on his board in 1993 when my partner financed his acquisition of Weston. And I had maintained a relationship with Barry. And Barry reached out to my partner, Boyd, and said, hey, look, I need a team. You know, he's an equity guy and this is a debt business. And he recognized that. And we came on board as the management team at the time at Starwood Property Trusts and built Starwood Property Trust from $760 million market cap on the day we started to $5.5 billion over 4 years. And that experience was a tremendous experience because it really was foundational to the whole non-bank lending sector, which today is significantly larger. So Starwood had this money. They needed loans. My job as head of origination was to convince the market to borrow money from Starwood Capital, which theretofore was viewed as a sharper-elbowed, very smart private equity firm, not a lender. And that was a tough challenge to go and convince Blackstone and Rockpoint and various other big private equity firms to borrow money from us. Lo and behold, we were very successful at it. And we built a highly profitable, diversified, just extremely well-run commercial mortgage REIT at Starwood. And then around about 2014, you know, the business was about $5 billion market cap. And we said, you know, wouldn't it be nice to go and build this for ourselves now that we've done and built multiple of these lending businesses? We were very fortunate that we got a phone call from one of the largest insurance companies in Japan looking to deploy capital and to back a team. And that then formed the beginning of Acor Capital.
What an incredible story. And I love some of the themes that exist throughout your career, specifically the one that you called out around, you know, partnership. And I think, you know, I'm guessing that the next chapter with Acor has to do with, you know, there's some more elements of partnership. But I have a question before we go there. There was one decision that you made that seems pivotal, and that was to either, you know, drop out of college or not go to college and go into hospitality. Why hospitality? I mean, what did you know as an 18-year-old in South Africa? Had you grown up around it, or how did you decide to choose hospitality as your starting point?
The thing I liked about hospitality was this comprehensive business approach to business. It's a fully rounded business, as I mentioned early on. And I loved the idea of business. And I really wanted to learn all the aspects, whether it's sales and marketing, finance, accounting, How do you buy one of these things? Who's going to lend you the money? Who's going to invest in this? How does all this work? And so it felt like a natural on-ramp for me to go there. Plus, it was Switzerland, man. I mean, how cool is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great decision. I just was curious to know how you got there. It's a good reason. And I think, you know, one thing I've observed in a lot of these conversations is that there's a kind of unintentionality. It's intentional, but there's an unintentionality about the path that people take and how impactful it is on their career. So it makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Acor. So, you know, you mentioned you had built these very successful businesses for other people, and now you and your partners wanted to do it on your own. I guess more specifically, kind of maybe give us the overview of Acor today, and then let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you're doing differently based on the lessons that you learned building for others in your own business.
So where we are today is Acor is a finance company, but our focus is solely commercial real estate, and it's solely credit. So that's senior debt, mezzanine, preferred equity. We position ourselves as the partner, the financing partner to the borrower, right? Let the borrower dream, let the borrower go and develop. We are their finance partner. So it's a little boring in that sense, you know, but it's, we are the bedrock that really makes the equity markets work. The idea at the time, so we're 145 people, 5 offices, and a couple of the things we had learned coming out of Starwood and Countrywide and Nomura is if you're going to get into the debt business in commercial real estate, you have to have scale. You have to have scale of capital, so you have to have the ability to service your borrowers when they need money all the time. It's not like you just choose to be in the market on Monday through Tuesday and then out of the market the next week. You have to be in the market all the time. Secondly is you need scale of intellectual horsepower, meaning you have to hire people. And this is a manually intense business, a labor intensive business. There's a lot of hand-to-hand combat. And you are going to hire people with high quality relationships. First and last looks are incredibly important in generating alpha in our business. Secondly, you have to have best-in-class credit and underwriting standards. So for us, the way we view our investments is we're an investor, first and foremost. Credit comes first. Volumes will have to follow based on the market opportunity, but really we are credit first. So if you're going to come and work for Acor, you will not survive at Acor if you're not a credit person. Meaning, if you're an originator in some firms, all you do is you run around just trying to find things and throw them against the wall and hopefully they stick. Not with us. We're very much about the quality of the investment. Are we going to get paid back? And because we're in a fiduciary for a lot of investors. So scale of capital, scale of people. So we kicked off the company with a sizable enough budget to go and hire best-in-class people, which we have at the company today. We got a $1 billion commitment for subordinate debt, which enabled us to do about $4 billion of loans. So the next thing I would say is if you're going to build one of these platforms, asset management is a huge component of these businesses. And one of the lessons that we had learned is in order to do this properly, there is a massive benefit both from winning business perspective, but also defense. So offense and defense in building a scaled asset management team. Our asset management team today is about 45 people strong in Dallas with various different disciplines, you know, apartments, multifamily, hospitality, construction. At any one point in time, we're running about a $3 billion construction book. So we can provide the borrowers with a number of different, you know, alternative products. So the lessons learned were we like the floating rate business, first and foremost. We believe that there was a massive opportunity with the growth of the non-banking sector. At the time, interest rates were zero. So the borrowers were highly attractive to borrowing short-term, you know, floating rate money. And transitional real estate is a massive part of commercial real estate because commercial real estate is always in need of renovation. So you take any building within 10 years' time, somebody else is going to buy it, they're going to put money into it, and they're going to hope to extract higher economic value out of that building, all things being equal, like growth in GDP, growth in rental rates, and so on, right? And so we believed it was a really good long-term strategy to pursue. So that's sort of where we are today. I think in terms of a couple of other things that have happened more recently is we have invested more heavily in the growth of our high-yield business. So the Acor core business is 65 to 75% loan-to-cost financing, best-in-class local operators paired up with big opportunity funds who are buying properties to renovate them, put in capital, new business plan, new hope, and deliver a new product to the market to achieve the best rents in the market. And our borrowers and our borrower base is really best-in-class operators and best-in-class opportunity funds. That's really who's there. And then also some high-net-worth people. The logical extension of our business then was we service 500-odd borrowers, and we literally have more than 80 borrowers with three or more loans with us, meaning they like the experience of our asset management team, they like the experience of origination, and they view us as a partner, really, their finance partner. So the logical extension then was to develop a pocket of money that is more high yield as opposed to 65, 75% loan to cost. Maybe it's 75 to 80, 85% loan to cost. It's situational. A borrower needs to close quickly. It was an opportunity for us to not only form capital and a product for our investors, but secondly, to deliver to the market and our borrower set and brokers a higher yield capital sleeve. And so we did that pre-COVID. It was a smaller vehicle. We then also formed a $1 billion vehicle to go and provide bridge capital to the hospitality industry during COVID. And that was really the idea being, these are great assets. These are great borrowers. These are great markets. Hotels have gone from having a lot of cash flow to zero income. I wanted to provide bridge capital between the senior mortgage and the equity to help bridge these borrowers to the other side. And that was a strategy that we deployed very successfully during COVID. And then that sort of built out or started building out what I would call our high yield business, Acor Opportunistic Credit. You may have seen in the press, to help accelerate that business, we hired Matt Drummond, who's an incredible talent. We ran a very detailed process. We had some phenomenal candidates. I actually felt quite proud of the receptivity that we had gotten for the position. A number of the people that sort of showed up were those that are in private equity seats where, unfortunately, given the instability in the markets, their promotes have gotten vaporized. They wanted to make a career shift more to credit instead of first-class equity based on their personal decisions around where the markets are going. And for us, we had a tremendous depth of a set of folks, very talented. I wish I could hire them all, to be honest. And I ultimately decided on Matt for a couple of reasons. You remember one of my earlier comments was credit first. We are credit first. So it was a cultural fit that we believed was excellent. He's very thoughtful. He's very detailed. He knows how to do the work. He's a team player. So when we take him as the head of high yield strategies and pair him up with my 26 originators, good things are going to happen. So that's sort of, you know, the extension of where we are today.
I want to go back to, I think, the very first point that you made, which is if you're going to get into the debt business, you need scale. And one of the trends that we're all seeing is this proliferation of debt funds. Some are, you know, first-time funds. And I know you're not a debt fund, you're a financing company, but there are debt funds out there. Many are first-time or second-time. Many of them are subscale. So how do you kind of see this proliferation of subscale investment managers in the market that requires massive scale and massive depth of talent? Is it a mismatch, or is there a future here where some of these shops will continue to grow alongside the growth that you've seen at Acor and get bigger? Or do we think that this is just a fad that will maybe eventually go away?
Yeah, I want to be cautious that I don't throw shadows on people or situations, but you've kind of pinpointed a very relevant comment in the market today. I think, for better or for worse, there's going to be many of those quote-unquote debt funds, many of them smaller in scale and mostly reliant on warehouse lines to the CLO market that are dead in the water. You know, their warehouse lenders are going to want collateral taken off the lines. They don't have the depth and breadth of multiple strong lines or the track record, and the asset yields are going to fall significantly, notwithstanding the losses that many of them are going to take. So I think that there's going to be many of them exiting the market. In fact, I get a number of calls from the subscale managers saying, do you want to buy us? Can we merge with you? You know, looking for an off-ramp. And, you know, maybe there'll be something that's of interest, but so far I haven't seen anything that's of interest to, that would be complementary to our business. And I feel kind of badly for some of those folks because they're stuck in a in an asset pool or pool of assets that are underperforming. They can't really raise more money. They're not going to get their CLOs done and make the returns they're expecting. Their investors are pissed off and there's no money to pay them. So, and then the other part of that is they have a fiduciary responsibility to manage those assets until they roll off, which could be 2, 3, 4 years from now. So it's kind of not a great situation for them. I was in a meeting the other day where a big investor was quite vocal about his perspective on that group of folks. There was a lot of bravado, at least he was indicating when they were pitching him for capital. They would come in there and tell everybody how smart they were because they could borrow money for zero and make loans at 4 and make the yield. But they didn't invest in the infrastructure, right? So we have a 6-person syndication team that focuses on the right-hand side of our balance sheet alone, right? It's a big team and it's an expensive team. You need multiple financing relationships. You know, to the extent there's an issue on one of your lines, you need to transfer the asset to another line. You need scale of capital because you need the ability to make margin calls and to pay down the loans or take an asset off the line. You know, so having scale is a massive advantage. And the barriers to entry to developing scale are very high. So when you think about these enterprises and these companies, to get to where we are today, 20 billion in assets under management, is, I would say, if I was starting this again, I would tell you it's closer to impossible than it is to possible. So what that's going to mean here is there's this massive demand for commercial real estate lending credit that's needed, and that you're going to see companies like Acor, knock on wood, emerge and continue to emerge as a very small group. I could probably count them on one hand of those that are going to lead the way forward here as the banks pull back.
And I want to talk about some of the fundamentals in the lending space. But before I do, you also talked about asset management. And my question is, you know, why do you need such a large asset management business? I understand so that you can be a good partner to your borrowers, but it sounds like you have an asset management that is as large or larger than a lot of vertically integrated investment managers might have. So what is their role and how should I think about asset management in the context of a financing business?
So when the market was all great and dandy and low rates and inflating asset values year in, year out, the role of performing loan asset management is not as dynamic as it is today. But we felt at the time that it was a differentiating factor that would enable us to win business. It would improve our ability to report to our clients, and it would generate higher repeat business with our borrowers. The reality is it was an expensive way to get there. But if I look at it, we definitely generated a higher return on investment than I was expecting. So I'll give you a live example, a real example. This was pre-COVID. It was a 22 asset portfolio. The loan was 188 million. Of the 22 assets, it was a wholesale acquisition, and they were going to sell off some of these smaller assets to 1031 buyers. And then the other assets needed capital invested in order to get them to their maximum economic value. So we were competing at the time with a large, well-established investment manager who outsourced their asset management capability. And at the time, our spread was SOFR plus 500. 550. Our competitor was at Surfer Plus 5. And I remember having a conversation with the CEO. And I said to the CEO, I said, before you make the decision, I want you to fly to Dallas, but not just you. I want you to bring your CFO, your controller, your analyst, everybody in that line, in that chain that is going to be involved with the financing and the implications of draws and future funding and everything else like that. I want them all to come to Dallas, including you. And I'm going to line them up with my team, my head of asset management, all the way down to the people that are administering the draws. And when we get to the end of the meeting and you feel like it's not worth the 50 basis points per year incremental to get your business plan executed, go with the other people. He came down, brought his team. We lined him up. I could see him smile, giggle, look at me, got to the end of the meeting. And I said to him, so what do you think? He goes, I'm blown away. I really am. He said, I'm going to sign your term sheet. Where is it? I said, it's here. Here you go. And he says, but before I sign it, I need 30 basis points. I said, I'm not giving you 30 basis points because you recognize that it's going to be worth every dollar to you to do this. And it was a joke between he and I, and he signed the term sheet. We did the deal. It was very successful for him and his investors and very successful for us. But we've used that as a weapon on multiple occasions, okay, on the offense. On the defense side, when COVID hit, you can imagine this, Brandon, every borrower was freaked out. But not wasn't every borrower was freaked out, so were investors. They did not know what to expect. So the ability to respond very rapidly, and as you well know, probably more than most people, technology ties to this too, right? And we spend millions a year on technology to enable a lot of this. But we were able to respond as quickly as possible to our investors, to our line lenders, to anybody else who is a stakeholder. We were able to respond very intelligently. And I thought that that was very valuable at that time. Now, going through this period of rapidly accelerating interest rates, we know the world is littered with issues. Having that backstop and that team to answer the phone and be responsive to borrowers not only provides white glove service to the borrowers, it also gives confidence to our investors that we've got it under control. And so I think it feels to me like it's a luxury in some sense, but if I had to calculate the return on investment, I would say it is higher than I would have anticipated going in. Had COVID never happened, I probably would have told you we spent way too much on asset management.
Makes a lot of sense when framed like that. Let's switch gears a little bit because I know a lot of our listeners are curious to get your take on what's happening in the real estate debt markets right now. Obviously, things are quite chaotic and we're recording this in August of 2024. So maybe just kind of paint the picture and describe where are we in commercial real estate debt and kind of how do you look at the current dynamics and try to extrapolate what the next, call it 6 to 24 months might look like amidst the uncertainty.
So you're right. We are in a very unusual period of time. You know, it was the speed with which interest rates were raised that caught everybody with a financial instrument off guard, really. And these clearly the rapid acceleration of inflation has its own series of impacts. As we sit here today with core inflation around 2% and a lot of improvement that's been made there, we're still facing extraordinarily high interest rates on the short end of the curve. We are facing an election, which is, I don't even know how to describe the whole thing, but it's almost like, are you watching a train wreck? Are you watching a comedy? I'm not really sure what we're watching, but every week is like a snowflake. It's something new. And, you know, it's hard to predict. But there are massive implications coming out of election years, which we can talk about a bit too. But when I boil it down and you look at the commercial real estate universe, I'm going to sound like a salesman here. But I've done this for 28 years. I've never felt like the risk-adjusted returns and the opportunity set have been more compelling than what we're facing over the next 1 to 5 years. And it's driven by secular changes, not just cyclical changes, and specific to the banking system, right? So the banking system itself is in some sense reinventing itself, right? The way in which they lend, the way in which they look at risk, and so on. And on the other side of that, where you have had historically the majority of the capital coming from the banking system, you have almost unprecedented demand for commercial real estate credit products, whether senior debt, mezzanine, preferred equity, whatever it is, short of equity. And the way I think about that supply and demand dynamic is that on the demand side, I view this as mentally four waves. If you could visualize four waves of opportunity, the first wave of financing opportunity is to finance the roughly $500 trillion of equity that has been raised for private equity firms to acquire commercial real estate assets, seeking high teens, 20% returns. That translates into somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion of need for commercial real estate debt. The second wave is this wall of maturity that is very well advertised, around $2.5 trillion of debt coming due over the next 4 years that needs to be dealt with in one way, shape, or form as these loans have matured. The third is the regional banks in particular, and the dilemmas that the regional bank faces today, which is multiple, balance sheet problems, overallocation to commercial real estate credit, increased regulatory frameworks, their cost of borrowing is historically high, they can borrow from the Fed window at 5.25 or 5.5%, their asset yields in many cases are lower than that, so that's negative leverage, the deposit costs today are 5+, so the banks have tremendous amount of pressure all around facing them. And that represents a very large opportunity to acquire loans at a discount, good loans at a discount, in order to facilitate and help the banks recalibrate their balance sheets. And then the fourth wave, which not many people are talking about, but I can promise you, Brandon, in 12 months from now, there will be a lot more talk about this subject, which is the need at the property level for capital. So we exist in an industry that is capital thirsty. There is a massive, it's like being in the desert. You've got to continually hydrate. And the hydration really is money that is needed to renovate, money that is needed to turn your multifamily units. It's money that's needed to satisfy your PIP requirements. With rates as high as they are today, the majority, if not all of the money is being used to pay debt service. So there isn't extra money floating around in the system. So that's going to create an opportunity. But if you take one step up and you can visualize a big round circle, that you could turn to the left or to the right, that's the Fed. If the Fed moves that circle to the left, you will see a tremendous amount of transaction volume on the new acquisition side manifest itself, along with that, a huge number of very interesting financing opportunities for folks like Acorn. The second one would be with a lower interest rate environment, that whole $2.5 trillion of congested refinancing opportunity will start melting and coming through the system because the cost of debt capital will be more attractive and available, right? The third part, really the banks. The banks will help chill themselves out with lower cost of capital. And finally, there'll be more money available for CapEx. If the Fed moves that rate dial up, it will stall out new acquisitions. It will just freeze the market. They'll be very slow and congested in the refinancing construct or universe. And there'll be a lot of opportunity from the banks and huge CapEx requirements. Now, that's just the variability around the short end of the curve and the dial that can be turned. I'm not a prognosticator. It certainly feels like we're going to get some relief here from the Fed in September and December. I think that will then help stimulate some of these markets for more transaction volume, which will be great for the markets. The second idea is with rate stability, a term that I use often. But rate stability will attract more bond buyers, will help liquefy some of the assets on the bank's balance sheet through the securitization market, which is really a positive thing. So there's this huge You know, if you bookend it, opportunity set that exists. But with the secular change in the banking system, the banks would rather lend money to folks like Acor today than do a ton of direct deals because it's better capital charges, it's better credits, the regulators look more favorably upon it, and they can deploy larger amounts of money with one counterparty like Acor than they can just running around making loans to borrowers. So I think that that opportunity set is very large. When I think about this, I think about the capital market side, and then I also think about fundamentals as two different animals. And, you know, this week we got some prints on GDP and labor that were not as attractive, and the market sells off 5-10 points. It seemed to be fairly irrational, but it was really a confluence of things. It was the winding down or the increase of Japanese rates, which put the carry trade at risk. The Japanese carry trades are borrowing in Japan and you know, taking that capital and holding it against as loans against assets in foreign places and skimming the yield difference. But it was very quick for the market to adjust. And I think what the market is telling, the equity market is telling you is that that was probably an overreaction. But notwithstanding that point, the Fed's risk is that they get behind the curve here. You know, inflation has settled down really well. They haven't cut rates. There is a very significant impact on commercial real estate liquidity, fundamentals, and valuations as a result of this high rate environment. And certainly, our entire industry needs the Fed to bring rates down for it to unclog itself, these issues that I've talked about, and then have a healthy market going forward.
One of the things that often gets discussed is, especially in this market environment, is that the real estate fundamentals are quite sound, but the capital stacks are broken. Do you agree with that take? How do you see the fundamentals right now?
So the biggest opportunity in a nutshell is broken capital structures, great real estate. And a lot of this real estate that's in trouble right now is great real estate. They just got broken capital structures. These, if you take a look at 2021 through 2022, it was the largest year of investment sales in history, right? There was a tremendous amount of product that got moved, and a lot of those multifamily and industrial buildings were bought at 3 or 4 caps. And a lot of it was financed floating rate, and a lot of that had 2-year rate caps on it. So those rate caps are expiring now, which means that the cost of debt has gone from 3 to 8. I'm not a mathematical genius, but there's trouble in paradise, okay? So those capital structures need to be dealt with. That's one thing. The fundamentals facing that market opportunity is actually probably what makes this opportunity exponentially more interesting. Because notwithstanding some noise in GDP and some noise in unemployment and some noise on the consumer, and there's a lot of talk now about going into a recession, and I can make an argument for both yes and no, but if you break these sectors down a little bit, let's start with the consumer, right? I hate it when I read stuff about the consumer where people say the consumer is really healthy or the consumer is not healthy without breaking it apart by income. What we are finding is these extraordinary high, you know, auto subprime default statistics, which are held up as a big statistic, are not impacting the wealthy people. They're impacting the folks that are at the subsistence level or at minimum wage level. So the distribution of wealth has never been more unequal than where we stand today. Think about it. If you have a 401k plan, which is not for everyone, right? You put your money in your pension plan, it's taken off like a rocket over the last 2 years. Now you're feeling great again. If you own a home and you locked your interest rate for 20 years, 10 years at 3%, you're feeling great. So a lot of this dislocation or impact of inflation is disproportionately impacting the lower income sector than it is the higher income sector. But the higher income sector continues to spend, right? And spend like drunken sailors. The second category is corporate earnings. And corporations, by and large, have outperformed certainly my expectations. My thought when rates ran up was that we were going to face a similar issue at the corporate level, where with rates rising 500 basis points, it was going to create a disproportionately high impact on corporate EBITDA and earnings. What I've subsequently learned is that a lot of that financing termed out into term financing as opposed to floating rate financing. And secondly, we've seen the top line improve significantly at corporations, so offsetting this impact. So corporations continue to, by and large, do well, and that's part of the reason why the stock market continues to run. The third category, which is massive in scale and cannot be underestimated, is government spending. If you take a look at what has been approved through Congress, I think it's about $7 trillion, about $2.5 trillion has been spent, and that continues to drive well-being in the economy. There's so much money available from the government to create jobs in infrastructure, construction, healthcare, massive, right? These sectors are doing really well, that the fundamentals for real estate continue to be good. So let's break it down a little bit. Let's look at apartments. Apartments, clearly, over the next 2 years, there's going to be some issues, particularly with supply. But I love it from a long-term perspective for a few reasons. One is, with higher interest rates, home ownership is unaffordable, right? Two is, we're short about long-term 7 million housing units in the United States. Three is, unemployment and wage rate continues to be unemployment low and wage rate continues to grow pretty well. Certainly when you're talking about not the low income necessarily, but the mid to higher income sectors. And then multifamily has this very unique financing mechanism built into it, which is Freddie and Fannie. So long-term fundamentals, once we get through the supply bumps, I think for multifamily are tremendous. And so you'll see us continue to do more financing in multi. Industrial has continued to outperform. Certainly there's some oversupply. Certainly some there, you have to have an awareness of the consumer decelerating and online sales maybe slowing down. But by and large, there continues to be a supply-demand imbalance there, and high-quality industrial is going to continue to go from strength to strength. I think hospitality is interesting. You know, it's highly correlated to GDP. It's demand. The softening in GDP would infer some issues there. I think we're going to see some real capital structure issues in hospitality. But it's continued to be a good sector to invest in. But I won't get into all the other asset classes, but one overarching theme is when 75% of all the bank financing was regional banks, and the majority of that was doing construction financing, and they're fundamentally out of the market, that means that we are going to see a significant, and we're seeing it already, slowdown in new deliveries in commercial real estate. Historically, supply has always been a big issue. It's killed the golden goose, and then we recover, right? But we don't really have that dynamic besides a few specific markets. So through my lens, I look at these fundamentals, and we will go up and down and have some bumps, and maybe we'll be surprised by weakness in the consumer here or there. But I think long-term, those fundamentals still remain really strong.
At the end of the day, it's all about supply and demand, right? I mean, just at a very fundamental level. I think that was a really appropriate overview and a good way to wrap up. We could talk for hours, and I'm curious to get your take on a lot of different topics, but I want to be mindful of everybody's time. If any of our listeners are interested in learning more about Acor, whether they're on the borrower side or just want to learn more about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to either find you or to get in touch with somebody on your team?
Stop by our website, acorcapital.com, and flow through, and depends on your region, reach out or reach out to me or anyone on the team. The addresses will be on there to contact us.
Wonderful. Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation today, Warren. Thank you so much for joining me and look forward to the next one.
Thanks, Brandon. Appreciate the time.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter @B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.